Hey there, this is your old buddy Tom, the Toonami Operations Module. Settle in, it's about to get good. Toonami's back, bitches.
Took you long enough.
This has been an experience we will never forget.
This ain't no time to go all mushy.
Don't lecture me. I've waited long enough.
Whenever you're ready.
Welcome to the televised revolution, as we drift through outer space aboard the Absolution. With Tom back in active duty as captain, in charge of bringing superior anime action. Yeah, you came to the right place if you have a taste for animation in deep space base. Broadcast through your television due to the progress of the Bring Back Toonami Twitter mission. The same block that brought us Sailor Moon and Dragon Ball Z is back, so stay tuned. I remember way back, never leaving my room. I stay glued to my TV weekday afternoons. Yeah, and thanks to Adult Swim, I have a reason to use the TV in my room again. Cause every night I'll be tuning in since they going back to showing action tunes again. Toonami's back, bitches. Wait, did you say Toonami's back, bitches? That's the official hashtag if you missed it, to celebrate Tom's return to television. Yeah, Toonami's back, bitches. Wait, did you say Toonami's back, bitches? That's the official hashtag if you missed it, to celebrate Tom's return to television. Welcome to the anime action fan sanctuary, with Tom providing that slick commentary.
And welcome back to my Toonami, and welcome to part 2 of episode 92 of Tom's Prerogative, as we continue to review Walt Disney's The Hunchback of Notre Dame. No pre-ramble here or anything. Let's just get right back into our review, as we have about an hour and 40 minutes ahead of us. Yeah, sorry. Can't be helped. I went off. Oh, did I go off? Get ready for the fun, the pageantry, the madness, the insanity. The ranting, the raving, and the gushing. Ladies and gentlemen, let's get back into Walt Disney's The Hunchback of Notre Dame.
Hellfire, dark fire, now Gypsy, it's your turn. Choose me or your pyre.
And welcome back, and now that I've had time to, you know, to rest and, you know, have a fictional cigarette, I say fictional because, you know, I don't smoke, but, you know, that fictional cigarette that you supposedly have after, you know, having a good one, because, 50 minutes! I can almost be called the Hour Man! Woo! I'm sorry, I'm all of a sudden segueing to the CM Jews Wrestling Reviews. I'll leave that for another episode. But no, seriously. Wow, I cannot believe I went 50 minutes talking about animation and music. Okay, I didn't technically go 50 minutes. There was a little bit of preamp there. I could more like 40 minutes, but again, you understand. You really do. You're already tired of listening to my voice. That being said, no, it really is, let's get back into it with acting, because it's not going to be quite the same ride. There's going to probably be another 15 minutes of this, because, wow, we have a lot to talk about, but let's get right back into it with acting, and that, of course, means it's time to go over our cast list. We have Tom Luce, you know, Pinto from Animal House, or National Lampoon's Animal House, mind you, as Quasimodo, the lovely Demi Moore as Esmeralda. She's technically Jewish. I don't really look at the Cabal religion fondly a lot, but they brought Demi Moore in. I'll give them that. But Demi Moore does the sexy and beautiful and smart and intelligent Esmeralda. Kevin Kline is the wonderful Captain Phoebus. You have Charles Kimball, from Murphy Brown as Victor. Jason Alexander from everything, including Seinfeld, as Hugo. The legendary Mary Wickles, sister act, Mary Lazarus, as Laverne. The legendary Tony J, as Judge Claudia Frollo. Paul Condal as Copeland, the jester. And, of course, the legendary David Ogden Steers as the archdeacon, moving up from being a clock to a church official. I love this cast. Oh, the geekiness in this class. I'm like, oh, this person did this movie. This person did this movie. Oh, I love it. Give me for a moment. I'm a bit eclipsed. I love this cast. And the entire cast was, oh my god, amazing. Even the parts I didn't like or characters I didn't like, I mind you, were great casting. The gargoyles were perfect. A lot of people hate the gargoyles. And we'll get into that when we get to story, because really they are the comedy relief, and we will be talking about comedy. But they do their roles perfectly. Mary Wickles, I thought, was the best of them, mind you. All of them did a great job, but Mary Wickles led that group. Oh my god, God bless that woman, and God rest her beautiful, gorgeous soul. Kevin Kline did a wonderful job. All of them did a wonderful job. So, and I want to get into each of them because they deserve it. So, let's get into it, of course, with our protagonist. And let's start off with Tom, who's, as I said, Bento from Animal House. Did an excellent and wonderful job in Quasimodo. There is this sort of natural innocence that he put into the character that I just love. He fully believed in Frollo. You could feel from his performance, I thought, even if it bit over the top, I won't even say over the top, but I can understand where some people may not understand where his character is going, but I really felt like there was this sort of natural innocence to his character that he had been brought up, to believe in these things, but there's something in him telling him not to. And the struggle within the character, and again, the great job of the character performance with the supervising the animator, which was James Baxter here. James Baxter, who did Jessica Rabbit. He worked on Belle, among other wonderful characters. Of course, we go on and do Kung Fu Panda. It's a leading animator over at DreamWorks right now. I love that man's work. The way they portrayed the character, the sort of tortured soul that Quasimodo was. And Tom Hulce, I thought, did a great job of bringing that out. This person who's been brought up all his life into believing this, while this movie, and let's not mention, we know what the theme is, this theme of acceptance. And while there's this theme of people trying to accept Quasimodo because of how ugly he looks, there's also a sense of Quasimodo having to accept this, that the world is different from what Frollo has taught him. And you can only imagine the type of things that Frollo has taught Quasimodo over the years. I mean, you get a taste of it in that first scene. And my god, that scene, to where they're going over the alphabet and, like, okay, A, abomination. B, whatever B is, whatever C is. D, damnation. E, eternal damnation. And it's just like, wow, this man has fucked this boy up. I mean, the only thing he apparently hasn't done is touch the boy. Okay, I admit, That was a low blow. Okay, I admit it. It was a low blow. I am a horrible human being. I could not resist any longer. It is a film. We are talking about Priestess. I admit it. It was a low blow. Tisk on... kind of hit a bit too hard there. Tisk on me. Boomy. I deserve it. That was a low blow. Okay. But... that scene, and you really, I think, understood through Tom's performance there of just really how Quasimodo did look up to Frollo. Because to him, Frollo was his father. He's the man who raised him. He didn't know anything else other than Frollo. And you could see it in his eyes. And then when you have him meeting with Esmeralda and her trying to in a sense, save his soul and trying to help him understand that basically what Frollo has said is wrong, you can see it again. James Baxter helped with just the great animation performance there as well. To understand that, it was wonderful. So I loved Tom Hulce's performance of Quasimodo in this film. But from start to finish, he was great. That innocence, and there was sort of a naturalness to it. One of my favorite sort of scenes is, some of my favorite scenes from Quasimodo is any scene he's in with Captain Phoebus, or at least two ones in particular. That first one where Phoebus comes back after Quasimodo has helped Esmeralda escape, and you know he's defending the bell tower, and it's like, you know, just give Esmeralda a message that I did not want to trap her here. I did it for her protection. Will you tell her that? Yes, if you will leave. Sure. If you put me down. Again, that's really more getting into Kevin Kline, so I think I'll wait for the other point, other scene to talk about when they get to Captain Phoebus there. From the start to the beginning of this film, I thought Tom Hulce did a wonderful job as Quasimodo. Just absolutely perfect. I really felt for his character. He really made me fall in love with his character and feel his pain. I thought he did a great job there. So I really did enjoy it. Even if there is something there I can't grasp my hand on that understands why some people maybe not like his performance. I can't remember it off the top of my head. I probably have to go back and watch the Nostalgia Critic's review of it. The Nostalgia Critic, I think, did an excellent review, by the way, of this film. Just to throw that out. And again, that sounds like I'm pissing up, but Doug Walker is one of the best reviewers. And I'm sure I'm not telling you anything that everybody doesn't already know, but I really don't think people appreciate his reviews as much as they should, to be quite honest. But with that, and with that sort of pimpage and kissing of ass out of the way, let's move on to Esmeralda. Oh my god, I love this character. I love this character. I love this character. I love this character. Why did they fuck up her story? I thought Demi Moore did an absolutely great job with Esmeralda. This is the heyday of Demi Moore's career. This is after she did Striptease, or was around the time she was filming Striptease. I don't know. I think she was filming Striptease at the same time. The production probably went on, or she was getting ready to film Striptease, or I don't know, because Striptease technically came out before this movie. I think maybe she was, if not doing the role, in preparation for the role, around the time she probably did the voice, because again, remember, the voice actors are recorded before the film is done. And so, again, that's why the animators are so important. In this case, it's Tommy Felucci, who, again, oh my god, his animation on Esmeralda is gorgeous, sexy, beautiful, everything. And smart. It's beautiful. It's gorgeous. It's perfection. It's angelic. That's the final word I can say. His animation of Esmeralda is literally angelic. And that's the perfect word for Demi Moore's performance here. She's angelic. She's sexy, strong, independent. Oh my god, everything you want a female character to be personified in voice. It's right here. In this character, boy, Demi Moore. in the heyday of her career, why Demi Moore is a absolutely wonderful actor. My God. Just because she did this character. I watched probably so many Demi movies just because of this performance. My God. I mean, of course, she couldn't sing to save her life. That's why they brought somebody else in, because, you know, I think it's because, you know, she smoked, and so she had a raspy voice. Another person said she couldn't hold the tune. I don't know which it is. And again, I don't hold it against you. You know, there are a lot of great actors out there that I love that, you know, can't sing to save their life. So that's not holding anything back. Again, start again. Heidi Mollander did a great job in that one song. That being said, I love Demi Moore's performance. I mean, she brought this character to life. That angelic quality, the independence that she added to it, just the sort of snappiness, but how do I put this? I think it's pivoting to where, really, when you understand her character is in the topsy-turvy, where, you know, she, you know, that entire scene, the first point to where Quasimodo rolls into her tent. And she's like, oh, here. And cares for him. And it's like, hey, by the way, like your mask. And that just a sort of element there. It just puts in the voice. Oh, perfect. Then the point to where she saves Quasimodo and releases him. It's like, I'm so sorry I did this to you. The caring in her voice. And then yet the defiance to Frollo. Oh, my God. Oh, it was great. And you have that moment to where the guards start to surround her, and she's like, oh, 1, 2, 3, 4. Oh my God, oh, what's a poor girl like me to do? And oh my God, it was wonderful acting. And it's little things, little elements of sassiness and sort of sarcasm there that just, again, showed the intelligence. I thought showed the intelligence, saw the strength, showed just all the little qualities in the voice that built up Esmeralda's character as more than just something that was a sexy-looking female character design. Because that's what it could have been. It could have been just eye candy. When you look at the design, it's easy that they could have done it. There was more to it. And again, it's through the acting, it's through some of the story. We'll get to the part that hurts her character in a little bit. But again, this, you know, just those little elements, of course, the song bit. And then my favorite scene involves her and Quasimodo when they're on the roof of Notre Dame. And, you know, he's talking about he's a monster, this monster, that. And, you know, takes his hand. And this is the other little aspect that really completes the character that Demi Moore did. That, again, I think made the character so angelic. And that's the maternal aspect. There is a maternal aspect to Esmeralda character. Sort of maternally for Quasi, and maternally for her people. A sort of mother of for her people, trying to lead her people to freedom. And it's where he takes Quasi's hand, and you hear it in her voice, that there's a maternal aspect to her voice as he's, you know, talking about, like, you know, and she's looking at the lines on her on his hand, saying, you know, he sees a lot of things, a lot of strength, friendship, all that. I see no monster. There's a very motherly thing there that really completes the character. It's what makes the character angelic. And it gives you so much respect for the character until certain things happen. I so badly want to get to that. You have no idea. And I'm just begging the Lord that when I get there, I do not screw up talking about that and go too quickly. Let's move on to Captain Phoebus. I loved Kevin Kline in this role. I thought he was excellent. To an extent, he was the comic relief. I mean, yes, you had the gargoyles, which we'll get to in a second, and you had the goat, by the way, voiced by Frank Whitler, because who else would you bring in to voice an animal other than Frank Whitler? As Scott McNeil legendarily said, you know, we can give it a choice between getting a live animal or Frank Whitler. Most of the dudes get Frank Whitler because, we have an animal, dude. We can get a real, screw it, let's get Frank. Takes direction better, too. Leaves less droppings. I added the whole less droppings part, but almost word for word, that's what Scott McNeil said about, you know, in praise of Frank Whitler, mind you. one of those legendary voice actors that I love so well. But to an extent, when you push them aside, to an extent, Captain Phoebus is sort of comedy relief, because he does have the moments where he's leading everybody, he's very heroic, and Kevin Kline is great in those moments, don't get me wrong. But it's the one-liners, it's the comedy that his character has that makes you like the character and you really enjoy. You know, the whole point to where, you know, he's with Frollo, and, you know, Frollo sort of picks up the stone and the answer, and he's talking about trying to find the Court of Miracles and what he wants to do, and he slams the, like, do you get my point, Captain? It's like, very, sir. A little one-liner's like, you know, like, I want you to watch this disgusting display, Captain. Yes, sir! This is little, cute little fun things like that. The whole little bit when he first meets Esmeralda and, you know, saves, you know, pulls the horse in front to block. And it's, you know, oh, I'm so sorry. Can't do a thing with him, you naughty, naughty horse. But by far my favorite scene, again, I love the scenes he's in with Phoebus' characters with Quasimodo. Of course, part of this is also the lead of him, so I'm like, how come every time I'm with you guys, I end up bleeding? I love that line. I really do. But it's a whole point to where they have to find the Court of Miracles, and they start arguing, like, it's a map. What do you mean it's a map? It's a map. Look, I have been in the Court of Miracles for all this time. I think I know a map of the city when I see one. I don't even know what's a map. But there's a naturalness. It's very, you know what it is? I find it funny because I was watching his film for a class, and thank God I did, because I probably wouldn't have thought of this beforehand, but now that I've seen it, and it was brought up, and there was a very scene similar to this, it's very Quentin Tarantino-ness to it. It's one of those things that Quentin Tarantino does, that sort of natural point of a discussion happening. You know, they're sitting here arguing about, oh, it's a map. What? Most movies are like, oh, it's a map. Oh, it's a map. Wonderful. You know how to read it? Yes. Let's go. No, they sit there for a moment and they have this little argument about a map. Like, it's a map. No, it's not a map. Yes, it's a map. How the hell do you know it's a map? I've been in the bell tower for years. I know what's a bell tower. You've been in the bell tower. How could you possibly know what a map is? Look, I've been in the bell tower for all these years. I think I know what a map. I've seen the city from the sky. I think I know what a map of the city looks like. I love it. I love it. It is a wonderful, beautifully done scene. They show sort of the very similarities to characters, these two characters who really care for Esmeralda. It makes these characters seem natural. And that's why I love it. And that was great sort of chemistry there. There's great chemistry throughout this movie, by the way. Kevin Kline and Tom Hanks in that scene had wonderful, damn near perfect chemistry. Because I really don't think what they could have done better in that scene. But Kevin Kline, I thought, did an absolutely wonderful job in this movie. Russ Edmonds did the supervising animation. Ah, my God. Awesome. And then you had the gargoyles, which, like I said, they were comedy relief. There was great chemistry there, too. And you know what? For the most part, I found them enjoyable and fun. Some people, you know, who really love this movie and really love the adult aspect of this movie, I think unfairly prosecute and are unfair to the actors here, and because of the characters and because they're obvious comic relief for children, because the jokes are to an extent very very childlike and as such. But really, they are very funny, and they do bring that needed comedy to the film. You know, I think a lot of people see it as being dark, and therefore it needs, you know, oh, you can't have any lightness to a film. But that's not untrue. You need a bit of lightness. You need some light comedy for dark films. Because you can't have a film be completely dark. Because it turns people away. And so, the gargoyles here, I thought, provided the right amount a sort of comedy here. I think the really the quintessential part that really gets on people's nerves is the song. You know, and as I said before, I really think the problem with the song is not that it exists, but that it's in the wrong place. You know, and by the way, I think another, again, it goes more to a story element. I agree with the nostalgia critic here. It would have been beautiful if it was revealed at the by the end that really the gargoyles were a figment of his imagination, but but you know what? It's a magical world. You know, at the same point in time, I can see the gargoyles are really a miracle of God bestowed upon, you know, Quasimodo. A poor, unfortunate soul who doesn't have any friends, and I'm going to resist the temptation to go into singing Poor, Unfortunate Soul. I thought Mary Wickles was the best of them. I thought Jason Alexander and Charles Kimball had a great chemistry there, and they worked off each other well, but Mary Wickles, by far, was the best. Sort of the straight lace of the group. And I thought she had a great comedy. Again, the ruddy gag with the pigeons. Which eventually led to her playing the Wicked Witch of the West and go, my pretties, go, my pretties. I almost fell out of my seat laughing at that one. I mean, I've seen it many times, but I still find it funny for whatever reason. I don't know why. Because they have the musical cue, the Wicked Witch's musical cue there played. I don't know why, but I just find it funny. And mind you, this is Mary Wickles' final film. So God rest her soul. It was basically released in 96. She died in 95. Jane Winters did the voice for her. See, I think she maybe did a couple of lines in this movie, but she picked up the remaining dialogue for Lorraine in the film's sequel. At least that's what my notes are telling me. But I thought the Gargoyles did a great job. I thought all of them. I mean, Jason Alexander. I love Jason Alexander as an actor. I think he's a funny man. I just don't think he's funny by himself. And I say that with all due respect to Jason Alexander. Jason Alexander is a comedian who does not lead the film. He's the comedian that supports the film. That's what type of character he plays. And it has nothing to do with look. It's just how he acts, and that's what he is. And this is a perfect example of here. Jason Alexander was there by himself. It wouldn't work. He needs Mary Wickles and Charles Kimball. I'll probably say Kimball. There for the longest time, but Kimbaro, to work off of it and to really make those characters work. So I love them as characters. I'm going to skip over Claudel for a second, Copen. Just to talk really quick, David Aden Steers, again, as I said, I love his character. I love it. I thought he did a great job as an archdeacon. Just that sort of regalness that he gave to the kid. Such a simple and really throwaway character, and yet he treated it with respect and wonderness that I just loved. So I just want to go on him real quick, because I definitely think he adds something. I mean, he is in these very important scenes throughout the movie, and you need a really good actor who's going to be able to play that small little bit, and yet play it with a bit of grandeur and regalness, and I thought David Oden Steers did a great job in that. And again, he has a great singing voice, I think, and that really shows in that opening piece. There you go, look what you heard on the steps of Notre Dame. Which again brings us to our final protagonist, Copen, played by Paul Candle. The mischievous leader of the gypsies, as we'll say, and oh my god, I love this character. I swear to God, this man was channeling Mark Hamill's Joker. He had to be. And I wouldn't be surprised if Kirk Wise and Gary Truesdale, basically said to him, hey, kind of play this like Mark Hamill's Joker. I wouldn't be surprised, because I swear to God, every time he was on screen, especially in Topsy Turvy and Court of Miracles, he was Joker-like. He was Mark Hamill Joker-like. He was comedy relief. He had important storytelling elements. He could have been a throwaway character, and yet he wasn't. And a large part of that was Paul Candle's, acting there. Again, Michael Suri did the supervising animation. By the way, for the Gargoyles, is David Persuma, and Dave Burgers did the Archdeacon. But it could have been a throwaway character. It wasn't. And again, just that wonderful little, very cartoony Joker-like voice, I thought was perfect for the character. It's what makes the character work. I mean, listen, watch this movie. Watch this movie. And tell me he doesn't sound like the Joker. Close your eyes, listen to him when he's on screen, and tell me that doesn't sound very similar to, or at least in the mannerisms and in the way that Mark Hamill would do the Joker, is the same thing that Paul Candle's doing. I mean, in mannerisms and sort of the high-pitchedness and everything, it was wonderful. I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if you said Mark Hamill was actually doing the voice and just gave the credit to Paul Candle to an extent. I mean, there's enough difference to say it's not Mark Hamill, but at the same point in time, I think he was channeling Mark Hamill there, and I love him for it. I love that character on screen because just that very cartoony sort of mischievousness that he gave to the character, I'll leave it as that. Oh, I love it for that. That leaves us to our antagonists, which, of course, there's only one. There can only be one! I am, of course, talking about the legend, the icon, Tony J. I think it's also pronounced Tony Ja. I'm going to pronounce it both ways. If both are wrong, I apologize. You'd think I love this man so much, I would know. I've heard it pronounced several different ways, and I've been confusing myself all day. So it's one of the two, I know it, and I apologize for even having to mention that. But oh my god, this may be the greatest Disney villain of all time. Maybe a smidge behind Maleficent. I mean, Maleficent, badass. I'm such a badass, they have to make a new movie all about her starring Angelina Jolie. That being said, Tony J is a close. And Frollo is a close second. My God. This man was brilliant. How this man did not win an Academy Award for Best Supporting Actor, I have no idea. If there are many things that show that the Academy is a fucked up piece of garbage and shit and vomit and crap that needs to be emptied into some sea somewhere, lit on fire, and burned to hell. There's a lot. But this is one of the big things to me that tells me that the Academy is a piece of shit that must be abandoned for the sake of humanity. The fact that Tony J did not get at least nominated, if not winning, a goddamn supporting actor role for his role as fucking Frollo is a crime against fucking cinema. This man was fucking brilliant! Every scene this man was fucking in was perfection. Perfection. When you look at perfection in acting in the fucking dictionary, Tony Jaa's face is right there. By God, the ant scene where he's talking with Captain Phoebus. The first scene where he's teaching the alphabet. Not to mention the fucking Hellfire song. The emotion, the pain, the anguish, the everything that this character is about, Tony Jaa did perfectly. I mean, it's fucking Megabyte from Reboot, for God's sakes. He did that during this movie. He did it actually after the movie. and it's a bit more cartoony. But this movie, mind you, part of the reason he even got the fucking part is because of his performance for that little small character in Beauty and the Beast. You know, the insane asylum guy, Monsieur Diarc. Yeah, that little performance there impressed Kirk Wise and Gary Tennison so much that, hey, you want to be the villain in this movie, Hunchback of Notre Dame, we're doing?
Yes.
Alright, you got it. I'm sure he probably had to fucking interview for it, try out for it. But yeah, he pretty much got it because of that role. My God, this role is perfect. He is wonderful, gorgeous, beautiful, everything in this role. As a villain, he does everything. And it's because he puts such emotion into this character. And it's underneath this dry performance that is just a beauty to watch and listen to. He's a great singing voice, mind you. But just everything in this character was done perfectly through the voice of Tony Jaa. Every emotion you needed, everything. When you need, I talked about perfection in the voice act. When you just look at perfection in acting, you look and you see Tony Jaa's face in the dictionary. I can't say anything else. It was perfect. And I talked about several scenes already. There's the scene with Phoebus when he's telling him to burn down the farm with the windmill. That whole scene to where they're in the church with Esmeralda, who's, or at least on Phoebus' word, said sanctuary, even though she didn't, and, you know, sneaks in behind, and, you know, he's got, you know, her arm blocked, and he's talking with her. And just the notion is like, I know that gypsies don't do well in stone walls. Oh, that's so creepy. I love this performance. I love it, I love it, I love it, I love it. You'll see me right now, I'm doing a fucking dance in my chair. I love it, 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 love it, love it, love it, love it, love it. I can't say anything else. I love it. It is perfection. Oh my God. Do I have to go to story? Do I have to go to story? Can I just end this podcast now? Have another spoke? Do I have to go to story? Yes, I have to go to story. Fuck. Oh. I don't know what else to do. Let's go to story. So, yeah. Whew. Wow. After these messages, we'll be right back.
Hey everyone, my name is Michael Bailey.
And I'm Jeffrey Taylor.
And we host a podcast called From Crisis to Crisis, a Superman podcast.
Presented by the Superman homepage. On the show... Wait.
What?
This just isn't working out for me. It's not bombastic enough. We need something epic.
Like what?
Welcome to From Crisis to Crisis, a Superman podcast, presented by the Superman homepage. I am Jeffrey Taylor.
And I am Michael Bailey.
From Crisis to Crisis chronicles the adventures of Superman.
Wait. I'm just not feeling this.
I'm just wondering how there's a needle scratching sound when all of this is clearly digital.
Look, all we need to say is that this is a trailer for a show called From Crisis to Crisis, a Superman podcast presented by the Superman homepage. My name is Michael Bailey.
I'm Jeffrey Taylor.
And every week we give in-depth synopsis and reviews for just about every Superman book published between Man of Steel number 1 in 1986
and Adventures of Superman number 649 in 2006. We also talk about the related Superman media, what was happening in the rest of the world when these comics were published, and what else was going on in the DC Universe.
The show drops every Thursday-ish at the Superman homepage, which is located at www.supermanhomepage.com.
From Crisis to Crisis is also a proud member of the Superman Podcast Network, located at www.supermanpodcastnetwork.com.
So join Jeffrey and I each week as we explore Superman during the post-crisis era, which includes Exile, Panic in the Sky, Doomsday, The Marriage, and beyond.
And write into the show at FromCrisisToCrisis@gmail.com and hear it read on the air, eventually, because we get behind on that sort of thing.
Superman created by Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster. Side effects from Crisis to Crisis include loss of money from buying back issues, a desire to read 20-year-old comic books, nausea, drowsiness, pizza, blurred vision, upset stomach, a desire to kick puppies and kittens, and backache from lifting boxes of Superman comics. If the excitement of From Crisis to Crisis lasts more than 4 hours, seek immediate medical attention.
Yeah, play it. Come on. Play it loud. Play it loud.
And now, it's time to sit back and enjoy the Two True Freaks Internet Radio Broadcast.
Illogic. Foolish emotions. A constant irritant.
Entire out! Freak!
Two!
Well, I'm in the circus. Right next to the dog-faced boy.
True!
I have come here to chew bubblegum and kick ass. And I'm all out of bubblegum.
Oh, shit.
It's a super prize package worth $9,388.
Money. This isn't the biggest bag over the head punch in the face I ever got. God damn it!
Ow!
And now, together by live simulation via the internet, your hosts, Scott Gardner.
He killed a police officer, for Christ's sake!
Thank God, damn, lucky he didn't kill all.
And Chris Honeywell.
Keep away! Keep away from me!
You are physically repulsive, intellectually retarded, vulgar, insensitive, selfish, stupid. You have no taste, a lousy sense of humor, and you smell.
Looking at me? Yeah, because she thought you're some kind of freak. Now, come on,
hey,
let's
God,
go.
She likes me, eh?
No way.
Shut up, you freak!
Julius, you...
I say shut up! It's a man on! A man
on! TrueFreaks.com.
And I'm back. I'm sorry I need another cigarette. Again, fictional, because I don't smoke, but... You got the point. With that, let's get into the story. And I really do want to get into the story, but... I mean... After going on about music, animation, and acting, it's like... Do I really have to go and talk about the negative here? I kind of don't want to anymore. Because I want to imagine that the downfall here doesn't exist, and that this movie was perfect, because it was that damn near close to being perfect. But, let's get to it. Actually, why don't we start off with something good, usually when you have something bad to talk about, you get an option of, do you want the good news or the bad news first? And a lot of people say, well, what's the good news? Make me feel good about it first, before you tear my whole life down. Even though I'm the type of person to say, give me the bad news, and then give me the news as I did the other night when I was told, hey, I have to take the SATs. The good news is, though, that if you don't want to, you just have to wait to get 30 credits to transfer to the college you want. But if you want to transfer now, you have to take the SATs. Great. But that's besides the whole point here. Let's let's give you the good news. The first good. We're going to do this. In fact, you know what we'll do? We're going to take the Stewie Griffin approach. We're going to do the sandwich technique. I'm going to give you something good, and we're going to go over the bad. And something else that's a little bad, but and something that's good and bad. But we'll end. Okay, not the sandwich technique, because we're going to start with the one good thing and then kind of get into the real bad thing. And I'm stalling here at this point. I don't want to talk about it. I really don't want to talk about it. Oh, my God. All right. I feel like I'm about to go into a wrestling match here. Let's get into it. Let's start off by talking about the main plot of Hunchback Notre Dame and the themes here. And, of course, those themes are acceptance of who you are, acceptance of other people who are different than you, and, of course, obviously, racism. Of course, the overall theme, I think, of the book is still in here as well. You know, the original novel by Victor Hugo, I believe I got that right. Yeah, Victor Hugo. Wow, I'm so glad I didn't mess up that name. Victor Hugo's original novel was largely about, you know, how the church has failed in its effort to protect the poor. Because that's what the book was a large criticism of. Of course, if you read in some of the pre-production of this, the executives of Disney weren't so happy at criticizing the church because, well, Disney is isn't to any one religion. You know, the executives are mindless fuck monkeys. These who do what they're told by their mothers. So, you know, they're not going to do anything to displease mother. me. You know, be critical of anybody. But, there was bumping heads there, but, I think there are elements in the film that do it in a very respectful element of criticizing the church, or at least criticizing part of the church, the part of the church and part of, you know, for that matter, religion that is willing to use hate as a tool of control. While at the same time acknowledging, those in the church who are trying to do good, it's just the unfortunate, you know, use of power can be damaging sometimes. But you know what? I thought the plot overall, Hunchback Notre Dame, was great. There's up until the ending, there's this great story being told of acceptance of this unfortunate soul in Quasimodo who, you know, doesn't think he'll be accepted. And in fact, when he goes out in the Festival of Fools, everybody's laughing at him. He's not accepted. He's looked at as a freak and everything, as a monster. Not until Esmeralda chooses to accept him that the others are like, maybe we're wrong. Of course, that really doesn't happen towards the end of the film. But, you know, it still comes. And of course you have Phoebus who treats him with respect. And once these people treat him with respect, and he starts seeing that, you know, it's not me, it's other people, and I should be proud of who I am. Again, a big element of a lot of Disney films are these sort of notions of being proud of who you are, and, you know, to an extent, racism is it's talked about, I think, a lot of Disney films, mind you. But that overall plot of building Quasimodo's character, showing him as this hurt, unfortunate soul, that it's just treated badly because of how he looks. And then, of course, also showing that through Esmeralda and her people being treated as basically they're nothing but criminals and whores and witches because of how they look, you know. And that anybody sympathizing with them is treated as such. It's just this very horrible thing by people in power who want to hold on to their power. And I love those sort of very deep discussional aspects of this movie. There, you know, I think the movie hits all the marks beautifully about how important it is to accept ourselves for who we are. How important it is for us to accept other people for who they are. To not make people ashamed of who they are. But there's this big theme, of course, of racism that is very obvious. But I thought it's handled tremendously well. I thought all the themes in the movie were touched upon beautifully with grace. They weren't hit over. They didn't hit you over the head. mind you. At least in my opinion, I don't think this film hit you over the head with really anything. Everything was subtly, was beautifully woven into this story that we are following. Because the main plot is that we are, to an extent, falling in love with Quasimodo. We care about his character. We become sympathetic to his character. And we want to see him be accepted. We want to see him, you know, win the day. We want to see him overcome Frollo's message of hate. Which he does, essentially. Maybe not in the way we like, as we'll get to in a second. I'm trying to hold off. God help me. But I thought the overall plot was kept simple. Because that's really what it was. It was simple. Quasimodo is this poor soul who is, you get made fun of, and people hate him because of how he looks. And him having to learn to accept himself for who he is, and essentially changing people's minds, along with Esmeralda doing the same thing. And that's why it's not hit over your head, because every story is part of this theme. It's part of the themes of this movie, I should say. And they all sort of, by just having the natural flow of the story, tell the themes and be the themes. They don't hit you over the head with it. They're, again, there's this natural aspect to the film that I just love. I mean, it's why I love watching it over and over again, especially the first half, as I'll get to it again in a little bit. Because that's not actually the big flaw. The big flaw is not that the first half of the film is so much better than the second, or at least marginally better than the second half. It's not the kiddie comedy of the gargoyles. It's not, to an extent, the pace of the film, which is off a little bit. At least in the first half. No, the huge flaw with the film, and I gave a lot of clues to it, and I really think it's why Hunchback didn't do so well, it's why I think people have criticism against it. I mean, obviously the criticism that it's too dark, I mean, that's obvious, and I understand that. That's not the issue at hand here. Of course people are going to think it's too dark for a kid's film. And we'll get into that whole problem of, again, the age ghetto that animation continuously gets pushed onto. I mean, because Hunchback of Notre Dame is not the first animation that's for everyone and that's really dark and really more for adults that gets put into that age ghetto and it gets criticized for not being for kids, which is absolutely ridiculous because it's never meant to be just for kids. Just because there's elements in there for kids doesn't mean it's for kids. No. There's a very simple reason to why this movie is fatally flawed. And that's because Esmeralda chooses Phoebus over Quasimodo in the end. Yes, you heard me right. Now, if you have, I know my friends probably know this already. I think I even said something on Facebook once a time ago about this. Asking, like, wouldn't Hunchback of Notre Dame be a better movie if Esmeralda chose Quasimodo over Phoebus? I think I said once upon a time on Facebook. So I think my friends who listen to the show obviously know that. I'm pretty sure I dropped some very big hints to that throughout this review, the epic review that this is going to be. But, you know what? I talk about simplicity. And I've talked all this review about how we've come to care about these characters. But more importantly, the two characters we care about the most are Esmeralda and Quasimodo. Now, don't get me wrong, we care about Phoebus. We like Phoebus. But we don't like Phoebus enough to believe that Esmeralda should choose him over Quasimodo. In fact, that's, I think, one of the fatal flaws of this film. That once you see that ending, you then go back and you see all the scenes and you realize it becomes flawed that they don't spend enough time of Esmeralda with Quasimodo. They spend too much time of Phoebus on Phoebus so that we would believe why Esmeralda would choose Phoebus over Quasimodo. The fact of the matter is, both men do great things. They're both in love with her. They both do things to save her. They both care about her. To an extent, they're really equal. They should be equal in Esmeralda's eyes. there's really no reason why Esmeralda chooses Phoebus over Quasimodo, other than the idea that, well, he looks prettier than him. And that's where, in fact, the problem lies. They really do nothing in the film to distinguish the difference between Quasimodo and Phoebus. Now, to play devil's advocate, I'm sure somebody will sit there and say, well, Quasimodo wasn't able to, you know, be as quick to distinguish himself from under Frollo's control as Phoebus. That Phoebus was, you know, never was really under Frollo's control, and that at the first moment to where he really, you know, you saw a scene to where he's rounding up the people, and Phoebus just getting madder and madder, and finally at the windmill, he just defies Frollo, and he gets shot for it. You know, he saves his family, and that's the ultimate thing. And I understand that, and that's a great moment. But that's completely unfair to sit there and say to Quasimodo, who is a man who essentially is jailed in the Tower of Notre Dame. The fact of the matter, and again, that's why this is flawed, because the fact of the matter is, we care the most about Esmeralda and Quasimodo, and we want to see them together, because essentially, Esmeralda and Quasimodo become Beauty and the Beast. They are exactly like Belle and the Beast. And again, remember, we come to care about Belle and we come to care about Beast in that film. We care about the Beast so much that, you know, we hate when he transforms. You know, and yes, I do agree, there could have been a better design of the prince overall, but the fact of the matter is, I do understand where the animators were coming from and that understanding of, really, regardless of who they would have picked, we wouldn't have liked them. I see both sides of the argument there, and I agree with both sides. Yes, it could have been a better design, but the fact of the matter is, we still wouldn't have liked it because we fell in love with the Beast. And the same thing in here. We fall in love. We become sympathetic. We care about Quasimodo and Esmeralda as if they're members of our own family. Because that is the natural aspect of an audience member in watching these films. Especially ones that do it this good about making you care about the characters. You know, Phoebus does all these heroic things, but in any of those scenes, there's really nothing that makes you sympathetic to his character. He's just the hero. He's the guy who can be the hero. He's the blonde-haired prince who does the heroic things. Yes, he goes against the army and gets shot for it. And, like, oh, it's sad he got shot. And you are sympathetic, but you're not more sympathetic to him than you are Quasimodo. And in a movie about acceptance, in a movie to where it's all about, here's this supposedly hideous-looking monster who is looking to be accepted. When you have this woman in this film who cares about him and is helping him so much, and yet, at the end of the day, chooses the pretty prince over Quasimodo. It hurts Esmeralda's character. It really does. It really hurts Esmeralda's character because it makes her look a bit, I want to say, I hope this is the right word, but a bit vain. It makes her look like, you know, that everything she talked about with Quasimodo is crap. Because she talks about how it doesn't matter what you look like, and, you know, just proud of who you are, and all that stuff, and yet she still picks the handsome prince over Quasimodo. In a film that is supposed to be about acceptance. Now, I mind you, I think there are, I mean, I'm sure there are lots of people that think Disney did it for one reason, and that is the princess always get the prince. In fact, that's why I say this is the film where I think this was firmly entrenched at Disney, in Disney movies, the princess always ends up with the prince. Yes, it was like that in the first, like, core princess fairy tale movies. And you had Belle end up with the prince. You had Ariel going after the prince. Yeah, Jasmine ended up with Aladdin, who became a prince, but technically he wasn't a prince, he was a street rat. Really. And I think Disney had done a great job of sort of discerning the idea by really making the princes seem not prince-like. But in this movie, you have this hero in Phoebus who is very prince-like. And yet you have this wonderful female character who you've fallen in love throughout the film with her and with Quasimodo, and yet she chooses the handsome prince really for what seems to be the fact that he's handsome and prince-like and does all these wonderful things. And you know what? It makes me feel bad for Phoebus' character. In fact, when you really look at what they do in the film, what hurts me even more is there are several places in the film where Phoebus is trying to actually seemingly get Esmeralda and Quasimodo together. Key point number one, in the Court of Miracles, when they get there and they go to warn the people, and Esmeralda's trying to thank him, like, don't thank him. Instead of, you know, taking the credit and, you know, of this woman who's obviously in love with him, it's like, don't thank me, thank Quasi. He was the one who helped us get us here. I mean, he did everything but damn near say, hey, you should be banging this guy. This is the guy who really cares about you. I mean, mind you, not that this is going to have that in the film. I mean, even at the end. And Quasimodo does the friend thing, too, by returning it, by the way. But he, like, he pushes Quasimodo to her after he's the one who fucking saved her at the end of the fucking film by doing this great heroic act. Yet she still chooses him. And yes, they tried to make it better by saying, well, Quasimodo wanted them to get together. Bull fucking shit! You can go fuck yourself! I mean, mind you, I don't think that they did it for horrible reasons, as some people. Because I'm sure there are feminists out there that want to say, well, that the woman needs a handsome prince, and all of that other bullshit. I think the end, you know, Kirk Wise and Gary Turnstile and the story writers here made a miscalculation, ultimately. Unfortunately, it's a really bad miscalculation that has hurt Disney hand-run animation brand for years to come and hurt the perception of Disney. I can't hate them too much for it, but at the same time, it did a really bad thing. Again, it's this example of a really bad decision on the ending leading to a bad ending. Not only hurts the film, hurts the brand. I mean, this was a really, really bad mistake and very flawed decision to make. When you really look at it, this is the reason all of this happened. It's the reason Disney has the perception, oh, the princess always ends up with the prince. And again, I think there's many reasons why they could have, or at least could have done it, if not did it. I immediately think of the, oh god, and I'm blanking on the name, and now I have to go look into it. Because I'm trying to remember it. Damn it. But, another one I'll get to right now is they could have been thinking, you know, we had the same storyline with Beauty and the Beast. We don't want to tell that same story. And that's very viable. I think they could have been thinking, you know, again, we had Beauty and the Beast happen again. To the extent we have Beauty and the Beast here, a very beautiful female character falling in love with a very ugly character, people could think that we're rehashing the storyline. And I understand that, but I think they miscalculated on that, if that was the reason. Another reason, as I was trying to get to, I think they could have thought of, was Jeffrey Katzenberg, famously, if you have the Aladdin DVD, talks about, you know, when they're initially coming up with design aspects of Aladdin, they originally have him very sort of weakly and everything. And he goes, you know, right now they had the design of Jasmine, who was very beautiful. I'm like, right now you have Julia Roberts and Michael J. Fox. That's never going to work. You need Tom Cruise and Julia Roberts. That works. Because you need the handsome guy be with a handsome female lead. So I think that could have been on the animator's mind and the storyteller's mind, and the idea that, you know, they needed Esmeralda to be with a more handsome person. Again, flawed in this decision. I mean, I think we'll never really know, because I listened to the commentary and they really at least I haven't heard yet them really talk about why Esmeralda chooses Phoebus over Quasar. I mean, they talk about how important it is to try to make us care about Phoebus, but the thing is, they fail at it. And the reason they fail at it has nothing to do with the scenes. They could have made the whole movie just us care, the scenes that we care about Esmeralda, care about Quasimodo, and then nothing but Phoebus doing heroic act after heroic act. Regardless of what they did with the character we care for the most is Quasimodo. And this is where it leads to part of the problem with this film is they spend way too much time trying to make us care for a character that they want us to believe Esmeralda a bit. They want us to believe so much in why Esmeralda will choose Phoebus. They spend so much time trying to make Phoebus look heroic, make Phoebus look like this person that Esmeralda would obviously choose over Quasimodo, not understanding that no matter what they did, it would never seem right considering what the storyline was. Because regardless of how heroic Phoebus was, it makes Esmeralda look vain choosing him over Quasimodo when those are the two characters we care about. And I know I'm going around in circles. But it also leads to the other part where one of my favorite scenes... I love this movie. But I have so many favorite scenes. But one in particular is the scene where Esmeralda and Quasimodo are together in Quasimodo's bell tower. Or in his room in the tower. Again, that's why I point to taking the Guy Like You song and using it to tell the story of this week that has gone by where Esmeralda and Quasimodo are together. They don't spend nearly enough time with Quasimodo being with Esmeralda. Especially considering that in the book, technically, when you really kind of look at it, Esmeralda, if she hadn't been killed, and again, yes, Esmeralda gets killed. I think she gets hanged accidentally, which drives the Hunchback insane. If I remember right, and I'm sure people will correct me if I'm wrong, I'm trying to remember the original story off the top of my head, but he grabs her and they leap off to their death off Notre Dame. And I think Phoebus eventually just goes insane in the insane asylum. If I remember right, I'm sure I'm not remembering it right. I'm sure people will correct me, and please do correct me. It's... but, you know, I would have loved to see more of Esmeralda and Quasimodo, because it seemed a whole lot more natural. Again, the scenes between Esmeralda and Phoebus had this more lust feeling. There wasn't a natural thing. It's like, hey, a pretty person is there. Ooh, a pretty guy. Oh, a pretty woman's there, and a pretty guy's there. Ooh, we're attracted to each other. And again, I love the Phoebus character. I hate to have these feelings of hate against his character. He took his girl. Because again, you care about Quasimodo. And the fact is, you don't have to change anything in the movie except the ending. All you have to change is Esmeralda and Quasimodo really coming out together. Sort of signifying that, hey, they're together. Or they're doing a little thing, obviously, in that little scene to where they hug. But really, that's the only scene you really need to change in the film. Everything else is perfect. With the exception of aforementioned gargoyle music. But as I said, really all you need to do is move that to a different part of the film. It just stands that's the major flaw of this movie. All of those things are what lead to it really hurting the movie. It leads to this bad ending that hurts the movie. It hurts the character of Esmeralda. And what eventually, I really do think, led to the idea. I mean, I think the idea was out there, but I think what put the nail in it and really made people believe that, oh, the princess always chooses the prince, is Esmeralda choosing Phoebus over Quasimodo. And it was just the wrong choice. And again, I think this is also an example of Disney saying, well, we're doing a Stark movie. We have to be more adult. We have to do this. We can't be Disney. No! Be fucking Disney! Because you are Disney! You need to take example from the movie you talked about accepting yourself for who you are and accept that you are Disney. Yes, you have the happy ending. Yes, you have the prince character, or prince character I call it, but you know, the main male lead end up with the main female lead, and there's nothing wrong with that, and anybody who has a problem with that is a crazy fucking nut job who doesn't understand that you're fucking Disney. It's why I hate these people who say, well, it wasn't original to the original, it wasn't faithful to the original novel. And really, we're supposed to have Esmeralda get hanged to death. Wonderful! Because that's what you want for kids. Not again that this movie was for kids, but mind you, this movie is for everyone. This is the Disney version of the story. And that carries weight. You know, there are tons of story everybody want to see done by Disney, because they want to see the Disney version of it, because there's respect for the Disney version of the film, or Disney version of the story, mind you. And I think that is one thing to hear, where they tried not to be Disney. This is really the one moment. There are a lot of things that, well, this movie really isn't Disney-like because of its dark themes and everything. No, everything in this movie is Disney-like. These are exactly the type of themes that they've talked about in Beauty and the Beast, in Little Mermaid, in Aladdin, in Lion King. They're very subtly put in, just like they are here. It's just that to an extent, it's sensory overload with the theme, with the symbolism and the art, and the fact that it really does finally take place in the goddamn church. We need to accept Disney needs to be Disney. Disney needs to accept that it needs to be Disney, which is why they need to bring back hand-drawn animation, but that's beside the point. Plain and simple, and I'll say it again, the biggest mistake of this film is really the one mistake it really made it in this film, and it leads to other scenes being a mistake, and that is Esmeralda choosing Phoebus over Quasimodo, because it makes Esmeralda look vain, it hurts the Guy Like You song, it hurts the fact that they spend too much, it makes it look like they spend way too much time on Phoebus, and not enough time on Esmeralda and Quasimodo. And I understand that the devil advocates here, or the other side, is, well, it was never about him falling in love with her, except that it goes against the tone of the movie. The fact of the matter is, yes, I am arguing for basically a different version of the story, but the fact of the matter is, both versions would work, and essentially, both, the version I am championing here, I think would work better. And I just think, there again, it goes back to this problem of two things. One, the age ghetto that, you know, we put animation in, that it can be dark and it can have all these themes. And yet, when it does have the happy ending, we not good for that. But again, we put in this age ghetto of, it basically, it can't be for everyone, it has to be for kids. That definitely was a thing, but I don't think that's the ultimate thing that hurt it. Again, I think the ultimate thing that hurt it, and I don't think a lot of people were very honest about this, is the fact of the matter is, when it comes to animation, whether it comes to comic books, video games, when we look at the video games, the animation, the comics, and all the pop culture that we like, we become to care about the characters. And part of caring about the characters means that we care about who the characters fall in love with. Because essentially, the characters become our family. And we want the characters to be with somebody who we feel will love them and is a great match for them. To an extent, we become Aunt May. And the characters we fall in love with are our Peter Parker, our little nephew. And we're trying to hook up our Peter Parker with who we feel is his Mary Jane. And yes, I'm using that analogy as a perfect example of how much I hate the fact that they're taking Mary Jane away from Peter Parker. Go fuck yourself, Marvel. Wow. wow, I'm glad I got that off my chest. Not the whole Peter Jane, Mary Jane, but like, wow, I was afraid I wasn't going to talk enough about that, about that talking point. And, I mean, there's little mistakes, little execution mistakes here, and I'll try to go through them quickly because, wait, how much, holy fucking shit, it's 1 hour and 7 minutes. And I stopped talking about, I think, acting around the 25-minute mark, which means I've been going 35 minutes on this motherfucker. Holy shit. Yeah, I'll get through it. Okay, that's it. I'm splitting this episode into two parts. There's no way about it. Yep. So, let's just go over the last couple parts. Let's first talk about, you know, again, the difference between the first half and the second half. Again, it's that element to where, again, that whole lightheartedness, and I guess it's more of an aspect that the second half was a whole lot more darker, but it seemed like the pace almost quickened a bit. And I guess we'll put pace of the film in this, because it's really the same thing. It's like, I felt there was a much more steady pace in that first half of the film, all the way leading up to Hellfire. And there was this great pace to the film, and steady. I thought the second half of the film just moved a bit too quickly for my taste. And again, I think largely because, again, really the second half is the Frollo's search for Esmeralda, Quasimodo and Phoebus, I blanked on the name there for a second, going to the Court of Miracles, and of course the final scene of the storming of Notre and defending of Notre Dame and Frollo's eventual death. There's really three core parts of that, where it just seems as if there's so much going on, and yet such a great pace to that first half of the film, because so much story is being told there. And yet, it seems like the story is just moving point to point in that second half. And it's a little execution flaw. I mean, mind you, there are things going on. But again, it's like they have really Frollo's hunt. And it seems like it's all that set up for Esmeralda to, break Quasimodo's heart and everything. I'm not going to get into that. That pisses me off. But, I think it's just a flawed little execution. So I guess the last point I'll talk about here in regards to the story is the comedy. I love the comedy here. Because I thought it was done extremely well. From the one-liners to Kevin Kline's character, of course, the little kid and the horse that's all. I didn't know you had a kid. Yeah, he doesn't take kindly to soldiers. That's good to know. That's cute. I did enjoy the gargoyles there. And overall, I thought the comedy provided the right bit of lightheartedness that allowed the movie to work, as I said before. Again, I thought Jason Alexander personally was funny, because I thought, again, he worked well working off the others. Charles Kimbrough and Mary Wiggles. I thought, again, that great chemistry there worked immensely. And again, the little Easter eggs and the fact that Belle is from Beauty and the Beast is in this movie. I believe it's in Quasimodo's song. Out there to where, they go down to the shop. In fact, there's two little Easter eggs. One, Belle is walking, through that scene, reading a book. And the other aspect is there's somebody beating a rug, and the rug is the magic rug from Aladdin. So again, those little Easter eggs Disney loves to pull. I can't remember a lot of Easter, but I know there was tons of little Easter eggs here and there. If I had decided to rewatch the commentary again, I probably would remember all of them. But yeah, I loved it. It's just, I enjoyed all the little Easter eggs. They made the film fun to watch. And make the film fun to watch over and over again. And even though it's hard for me to watch sometimes, because it's as I'll talk about in Legacy, why it gets harder and harder to watch every time I watch it. And you know what? For the most part, I enjoyed the comedy. The comedy was fun. I mean, and mind you, to me, part of the comedy is also the adult thing that they put in this movie. They have a fucking striptease in this fucking movie. Not technically a striptease, but they have a pole dance scene. I mean, technically, Esmeralda's dance at the Festival of Fools is an erotic burlesque strip dance without the stripping. I mean, she takes a spear, she puts it in the fucking middle of the stage, and then twirls around it like a stripper. I'm like, they fucking put this shit in a movie? In a Disney movie? God bless America, land that I love, and design and guide God bless the people at Disney. Yes, I am chanting and cheering for the striptease. What a shock. I never change, folks. I never change. But even the nut shots in this film, I'm like, you don't get much more Looney Tunes than fucking nut shots. I'm like, and not just one. They do several. I'm like, yes, thank you. And they're beautiful nut shots, by the way. I'm sorry. I love a good nut shot. And they have several pretty good ones in this movie. Again, the whole point of, you know, when in doubt, hurt whoever you decide to hurt. In this case, the fun part about it is, a lot of times, that person is famous. And I love it. When in doubt, hurt Phoebus! Which makes the line of, how come every time I'm with you guys, I end up bleeding, is so hilarious to me, because it's so true. So, I mean, there was, if not just kiddie comedy, there was some adult comedy in there that really made me enjoy the movie more. And all the little Easter eggs, and because this is a movie that is really more for adults than it is for kids, but really is still for everyone. It's a movie for adults that kids can watch. That's really the point about this, is that this is a movie for adults and for a much more mature audience that kids can watch. And I guess that's the point. And I guess that's a great segue into, you know, talking about my final review, Hunchback, and its legacy. You know, like I said, because of that huge flaw of Esmeralda choosing Phoebus over Quasimodo, you know, again, that persona, that idea that the, you know, Disney, the princess always gets the prince, I think that was the nail in the coffin. And I ultimately think that has been a detriment to the legacy of Walt Disney's animation. Because certainly feminists have been able to run with that. And I think you see it in Brave, or I should say, you see its detriment in Brave, in Frozen, to where Disney seemingly has to go out of their way to somehow prove they're not sexist. There's nothing sexist about it. It was a miscalculation of who the audience would care about more in the film. Especially when love between two characters is a natural part. It's, mind you, we're already over an hour, and we don't have time to get into the, because it'll be another hour if I start going into the detriments of that whole argument. And I don't say that out of disrespect for the argument or the other side. It's just, oh my god, I need a rest. I've been doing this review for 2 hours, folks. 2 hours. By myself. And this time I haven't needed to use music to enhance those 2 hours. But, or a guest star. My god, how am I going to do this with classmates? It's just something to where, I think ultimately, again, because of that major flaw, it led to that idea of what Disney is, which was wrong, but led to the audience believing that. And I don't think the audience really liked it, because again, I think, because the person you care about doesn't get the girl, I think audience, or just gets the guy in some cases, I think audiences do care about that. And so while they enjoyed the movie, they didn't enjoy it as much to go see it again. And while I know a lot of people like me are glad that a lot of more people are realizing how much they love the film and have bought it and have, you know, watched it again and again, at the same point in time, it still has that stigma. And it really is because of that really big flaw. And it is. It's a big flaw in the film to have Esmeralda choose Phoebus over Quasimodo. Because that is the natural aspect of us caring about characters. We fall in love with characters. We care about characters. It isn't childish to care about characters. It isn't a sign of insanity or craziness to care about characters. It's a sign of insanity when you think they're real and they're right behind you and they're your friends and they want to... or that Esmeralda's in the bed beside you. That's insanity. What's not insane is, like, I really care about Quasimodo and Esmeralda, and I really think they should have ended up together at the end. Because I thought it would be a better story. Which it would. I mean, if you really understand it, and really look at how Disney should have done it, it would have been the better story. And it probably would have made more people go see it again. Because making it a more heartwarming story would have been a perfect end to all the themes. Because Esmeralda and Quasimodo ending up together, not necessarily saying they'll get married, but that they're basically together as a couple, would have gave it the right amount of heartwarmingness that would have made the film end on that right note, on that perfect note, and it would have made the film almost damn near perfect. Again, except for the gargoyle singing scene, but we have beaten that horse to death already. With a jackhammer. I mean, because it isn't, because it's Quasimodo and the scene, which I really didn't go to, where it's, they really looked like they were low on budget, and I think they should have had more crowd people, and or at least I felt the square should have been more crowded than what it is at that end where he's being carried off into the sunset. It kind of left it on an anticlimactic note. And you didn't feel fulfilled as an audience member. And all in all, I think that has really hurt the legacy of Walt Disney Animation because a lot of people didn't feel like they were getting their money's worth and chose not to go see Hercules and not to see Mulan or Tarzan. I think they're starting to come back because of Frozen. And you don't know how much it hurts to say that, but I will respect Frozen at the popular movie it is. Again, I'm not going to get into that argument. But at the same point in time, it's that downfall of people not going and that loss of money, which ultimately led to executives thinking, hey, well, I guess hand-drawn animation isn't what it used to. We should really pull it because it won't bring in money anymore. No. Especially when they not completely true. I mean, especially when you miss, you know, promote a film like The Princess and the Frog, among other things. The fact of the matter is, hand-drawn animation is just as viable as CG. But if you promote it wrong, or if there's a flaw in the story, of course it's going to do bad. As I thought, well, again, I'm not going to get to that argument. You know, the fact of the matter is, ultimately, I love Hunchback of Notre Dame. If they were to, as I said before, when you take out that huge flaw of Esmeralda choosing Phoebus or Quasimodo, and the Hunchback and the gargoyle singing scene, at least from the place it is, this movie is damn near perfect. But because of the gargoyle scene, which is again, like I said, is in the wrong place, that gargoyle song. But more importantly, because of Esmeralda choosing Phoebus over Quasimodo, it gives it a climactic ending that doesn't feel satisfying. And therefore, really hurts the movie. It hurts Esmeralda's character. It hurts the theme, because again, it makes it seem like the theme was just bullshit. When they shouldn't. And the fact of the matter is, it it makes it harder and harder to watch this movie, because you watch this movie and you see, oh my god, this is perfect, and this is gorgeous, this is beautiful, it's pretty, oh my god, this film was wonderful, and you get to the ending and it's like, you know what, I finally figured out how to symbolize this in the perfect way. It's like spending the past 22 years of your life, or it was really 24, I think, because you started, I think, what, WrestleMania 6, I want to say? But it's like you have been, since WrestleMania 6, watching The Undertaker in the WWE win at WrestleMania, and he's been 21-0. And you sit down and you watch WrestleMania 30, and it gets to Undertaker versus Brock Lesnar. And mind you, the storyline of the streak, discontinuing the match, which was horrible, mind you, but, you know, the story of the streak was perfectly done up to that point. And then they have Brock Lesnar beat The Undertaker in the most unepic, unsatisfying, anticlimactic way possible. And you're left with a bad taste in your mouth. And now every time you rewatch the streak all the way through, you're like, oh my god, this sort of storyline through these WrestleManias is perfect. And then you get to that point at the end, it's like, how could they fuck it up? It's the same thing I feel in this movie. I watch this movie and I love every moment of this movie. And then I get to that end and I see that Esmeralda is choosing Phoebus. Even to the point to where they make Quasimodo like, hey, you two should be together! And I'm like, how could they fuck this up? How could they fuck this movie up so much? This movie should have been perfect, and they fucked it up! And it's the thing, I want to know why. What? Who made the choice? How could all these great people make such a horrible miscalculation? Story-wise, these are brilliant people who did Beauty and the Beast, Aladdin, Little Mermaid. How could they do this? It doesn't make sense. I firmly believe that somewhere there is a draft of this film where it's the other way around, and for whatever reason, they never did it. So, end of the day, what do I rate this film? I rate this film a 3.75. That's... You know what? That's cheating. So, you know what? I'm going to accept the bullshit to come away. This film gets a 3.5. This is my fifth favorite Disney film of all time. Fifth favorite Disney film of all time. Okay.
I'm wrong.
It's my third favorite Disney film of all time. I want to make sure I get that right. This is my third favorite Disney animated film of all time. And yet, if I had to rate it, I'd give it a 3.5. And if I'm not mistaken, I gave Frozen last episode either a 3.5 or a 4. So a movie I had so much problem, I'm basically rating Hunchback the same, if not a bit worse, than a movie that I felt I had a lot of problems with. That should tell you about something about how bad that ending is. I mean, end of the day, I think any Disney fan and any animation fan should have this movie, just for the fact of showing you how you do things perfectly, but yet how you can mess things up. And I'm very passionate about this, because I love this film, and yet it seems like every time I watch it, it gets harder and harder to watch. Maybe doing this review and getting it out there, you know, it will be the thing that heals me. It will be the thing, it's the thing that allows me to move past the ending. And maybe enjoy it a bit more. But overall, it's this thing to where I watch it and I love every moment of the film till I get to the end and they're not together. And I just how can they mess this up? So at the end of the day, The Hunchback of Notre Dame gets a 3.5 out of me. And that is it for this episode of Tom's Prerogative, episode 92, which by now I'm doing this recording. This part of the recording is going to be 92B. Music and animation is probably going to be 92A. I thank you for allowing me into your homes and dealing with my insanity, because this is insanity. I fully admit it. I fully embrace it. And what I do here is absolutely insanity. Hopefully, you were at least entertained by it for... It's what? Hour 27? Basically, the 2.5 hours. Or I should say, the 2 hours and 10 minutes that I've been doing this pod, or at least this episode. If you have any emails or comments or anything you want to send my way, especially about this episode, if you disagree, agree with anything, remember there are several ways you can contact the show. One, you can contact the show at absolutionnetwork132@gmail.com. That's absolutionnetwork132@gmail.com. You can also leave us a comment on our Facebook page, which you can find at www.facebook.com and search for the Absolution Network. Find us, like us, leave us a comment there. And by the way, I am also trying to get us a page on Twitter. Are trying to get on Twitter. Hopefully I will. And by the way, if you're listening on Twitter, if there's a comment section there on that page, you can leave us a comment there. I'm just in preparation for hopefully getting there. And finally, you can also leave us a comment on the website itself that you can find at www.an.132productions.com. You can also make sure to check out all our other 132 productions, which I hope you enjoy. This is, of course, includes the Otaku Momentum, and, of course, my wrestling reviews, or the Otaku Momentum, done by Neo Kaje. And, of course, my wrestling review podcast, CMJew's Wrestling Reviews, which you can find right here on the Absolution Network site. Of course, the Shaft Plus podcast with Gene and Chris, that you can find at www.shaftplus.com. They do wonderful stuff. They're so funny. And I'm thankful they give me this space for my insanity to exist. And, of course, my other podcast, which includes the Tokyo SOS Godzilla podcast, that you can find at www.tokyosos.132productions.com. And, of course, my comic book crazy podcasting site, which includes CMJew's Comic Book Crazy, Hexcast, and Spectacular Webs, which you can find at www.comicbookcrazy.132productions.com. And while you're at any of the sites, remember to check the sidebar. Check out all our great friends, which of course includes Michael Bailey's Views, Longbox, Brad Douglas' Spider-Man, Crawlspace, Steven Schleicher's Major Spoilers Podcast, and of course Scott Gardner's Two Freaks Podcast and Network, along with many others on the sidebar of the site. So that is it for this episode of Tom's Prerogative. We're done with Disney for at least a year, especially after this epic podcast. If I had got done what I wanted to, we'd maybe have some space to do some extra film, but we don't. I'm gonna. I actually do need a break for finals and stuff. So I'm gonna actually take another bit of a breather, and I'm going to. Well, really, I'm not. I just looked at the schedule, I'm like, that's how late this is into April, that I actually can't take the breather anymore. I planned on taking a breather. But this podcast was so epic and needed so much preparation and Passover and everything that I don't have the time for anymore. Because I am going to get the next episode out on either May 1st or 2nd. And since it is the month where you have all the action movies, it is time for Superhero Month once again here on the Absolution Network. And we're going to start with a great one. A new movie that came out, I think, about a year, if not a year ago, 6 months ago, I think. I'm, of course, talking about Iron Man Rise of the Technovore. So that is it for this episode of Tom's Prerogative. Until next time, my Tsunami Generation.
Find cover. It's gonna get too dangerous.
Stay gold.
Hope you enjoyed it. This is Tom signing off. And until we meet again, you know the rest.